Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Solieri Report a gentleman who needs no introduction. I should say not just gentlemen, but gentlemen and a scholar, Dr. Joseph Farrell, who's joining us today for our quarterly Solieri Report with him. And we were talking earlier about what we wanted to cover. And I said, you know, as we discuss this idea of going from global 2.0 to 3.0, there's nothing more fascinating than trying to make sense of the scientific and technological developments. And one of the things I most enjoy about Joseph's website, GizaDeathStar.com, is just the tremendous coverage he gives to the latest stories and helping us understand the latest stories about science and technology. So, Dr. Joseph Farrell, welcome to the Solieri Report.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back.
Are you ready to engage in some high-octane speculation?
Oh, you know it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, not everybody may be familiar with my term of global 2.0 to 3.0, so let's talk a little bit about global 3.0. We're going through a change, and a lot of that change is, in fact, driven by technology, but maybe if you could give your take on what I mean when I say global 2.0 to 3.0.
Well, my take is this, and I just talked about this recently on my own website with my web developer, and my take is this. If you look carefully at the technology memes that have been pushed in, let's say, the last 5 to 6 years, there seem to be certain technologies and memes that constantly recur. One of them is space and space commercialization, private development of space resources and assets, such as asteroid mining, mining on the moon, usually in connection with helium-3, mining other celestial bodies, and so on. That's been one meme. The other meme has been new energy technologies, and this is a particularly fascinating one. I've got several blogs scheduled over the next couple of weeks on my website dealing with energy technologies. And the story of the moment seems to be both fusion in its hot sense and in the cold fusion sense. That's been yet another meme, alternative energy technologies. The third meme that has been recurrent, and you've pointed this out many, many times on Solieri, is the new manufacturing processes, additive manufacturing or 3D printing. And I've pointed out on my site in various interviews and so on that 3D printing looks to me to be the first step in the technology tree to, you know, the old Star Trek replicator transporter capability. And they've already used 3D printing in space matters. NASA recently took a photograph of a rock on Mars and 3D printed it on Earth to have a better look. Now, I don't believe for a moment it was just a rock. I think it was probably something unusual that may have had some anomalous artificial qualities that they wanted to look at. But this is already being done. The other thing that I think is happening is if you look carefully and combine all these things together, we've seen recent articles on phys.org about scientists in Australia have successfully tested a tractor beam, talking about Star Trek again.
Right.
That has been able to move and both pull and push objects, tiny little objects in laser beams, to a distance of about 20 centimeters. Now this is a huge leap from previous capabilities. That's almost 8 inches that they've been able to move objects forward and backward inside of a laser beam. So you put that together with the recent NASA DARPA announcements that I talked about when we were together up at the Secret Space Conference, DARPA has come out and made a stated goal that they want the United States to be warp capable in 100 years. Now, you know, warp drive is, again, that's a Star Trek science fiction concept to a certain extent, but what that would mean is vastly shorter transit times for space travel. You know, from Earth to Mars would not take a matter of months, it would take a matter of minutes. So, you know, we have all this coming down, and when you put all of it together, new energy technologies, new technologies in terms of robotics and additive manufacturing, new technologies in terms of energy, new technologies in terms of being able to scan and print objects remotely at a distance. We're getting very close to the idea of teleportation. And
right.
It looks to me that if you look at it in the whole, what you see happening is they are quite literally releasing into the public stories of technologies which, when put together, look like Star Trek. I mean, we've got warp drive, we've got teleportation, we've got tractor beams, we've got replicators.
We've got materializers. Yeah.
Exactly. We're on the cusp of, in the next 100 to 200 years, we're on the cusp of a drastic change in the way human society will be organized, in the way that things will be manufactured. This will drive down, many of these technologies will drive down transportation costs dramatically. We won't see trucks hauling things across the country. We'll simply dial it up and 3D print it. You know,
right, exactly.
Either at home or in a warehouse. So, you know, this is going to drive down costs tremendously when these things actually come online in a major way. So,
you know, I laughed tremendously this morning because a lot of what is holding back the 3D printers is the economics of the materials.
Right.
So there's a real dovetail between the fabrication technology and the new materials. And, of course, you'll read a story about what graphene can do, and it's real exciting until you discover what the expense is. And this morning the president announced, the headline was this morning, a whole new series of initiatives and supports to manufacturing, all designed to bring the cost of the materials down.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
It's going to change so many things, Catherine. Labor costs, transportation costs, energy costs. The thing that's very intriguing to me about cold fusion in terms of this global 3.0 model is if you look at the various claims out there about fusion processes, we had in the last 3 weeks, we had the University of Uppsala and the University of Bologna in Europe releasing a paper of their examination of the ECAT cold fusion reactor of the Italian physicist Dr. Andrea Rossi. And in that paper, it's very clear that these two major universities have come right out and said, this is a real process, it really works, we are getting nuclear reactions at thermal energy levels far below the hot fusion model. And that in itself is very interesting because if this reactor can go online to produce practical energy, it would be very, very cost efficient. And within a matter of days of this paper being publicly released, of course, we had the Lockheed Martin story that, you know, oh, by the way, we have a hot fusion reactor that within 5 years, we're hoping to be able to put on the back of the truck.
Right.
Now, I find that a little suspicious in the timing of it because the Lockheed story was not accompanied by any data, so to speak. And I think really the timing of it was to take some of the thunder away from Rossi's cold fusion device.
But what about the Russians? Because the Russians had also come out.
The Russians and the Chinese have a fission fusion reactor that they're talking about. So the bottom line here is energy, the other thing that fascinates me here is, again, the sequence of the timing of these stories. About 2 weeks prior to the cold fusion announcement of the two universities in Europe, there was an announcement that the Rockefeller Foundation Group had divested itself of all petroleum stock, which I thought extraordinary. And then, of course, we had Rossi's fusion announcement, and then the Lockheed announcement, and the Russians and the Chinese. So, in other words, they're telling us that get set for huge changes in the world energy situation over.
Well, except for let me step back, because I'm a great believer that I think what's, you know, the oil price has been coming down, and we just had Goldman Sachs come out today and say the oil price was going to hit 70 in 2015. Mm-hmm. I think, Joseph, what you're watching is a hit on the Russians. In other words,
I do too.
If you want to bring Putin to his knees, you have to cut the oil price. Right now, 87% of the fossil fuel or the energy demands on planet Earth come from fossil fuel. So, you know, and Putin's sitting in the catbird seat in terms of oil and gas. And if he grabs the Arctic, then he's going to be the largest instead of the United States. So it seems to me there's a real effort here to bring him to his knees. You know, the Rockefellers are making it look fashionable, but I'm not sure if that's real. Unless, of course, they bring out this technology.
Yeah, I think part of it's real, and I do agree that much of the manipulation of oil and energy prices, oil and coal and natural gas and so on, is an engineered geopolitical scheme against the Russians. This was the same strategy that the United States and the West used against the Soviet Union in the final days of the Gorbachev era. And interestingly, it's interesting that you mention this, because I have a blog scheduled in the next couple of weeks about an interview that was given on Rossiyskaya Gazeta by Nikolai Petrushev, which is one of Putin's close advisors. He's the former director of the Russian intelligence services, the FSB, and he's currently the president of the Russian Security Council. And this is exactly his analysis of the situation. And he makes it very clear that the Russians know that the United States is trying to play this game again. So, I agree that much of this is manipulation. But I do think that all of the Russian matter aside, that we are looking at a deliberately driven set of means here that the elite seems to be pushing fusion energy in one form or another. So if Lockheed comes out in the next few years with more details on the reactor process, and I can't envision that Lockheed would be making statements that are just hot air. They have to have something behind it that gives them the confidence to make the story announcement that they made. So I do think that energy itself, we both know the connection between energy and the financial system, and this is a signal that we are not only in for huge changes in the next few decades in terms of our energy supply, we're in for huge changes in the financial system as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Fusion, you know, just to remind people, fusion is an energy source that's basically not subject to non-renewable resources. So in other words, the financial game changes dramatically in that situation.
Right. What it means is, you know, put aside the oil and gas industry. What it means, though, for manufacturing, the number one cost of manufacturing in the United States is energy.
Right.
So you're suddenly going to make the developed world phenomenally competitive.
Yes.
In terms of labor, with both lower energy costs and robotics. Suddenly.
And lower transportation costs.
Right.
Yeah.
So you could see manufacturing fly back.
Oh, yes. Easily. I really think that this is going to be a huge story, both in terms of investment opportunities in the next 10,
right,
20 years, And you've been pointing out several times that they seem to be moving to an equity-based system of finance. And given all these developments, I think that's quite true. We're going to see a very different kind of investment atmosphere in terms of manufacturing over the next couple of decades.
You know, clearly, one of the things we do see is using technology to maintain much more invasive individual and collective control.
Yeah.
And one of the things I sometimes wonder about is if they're scared to death to bring this technology out without having that kind of control. If there's a relationship between the desire for invasive individual control and the introduction of very powerful energy technology.
Oh, yes, I totally concur. In fact, this is something that I've been talking and discussing with members on my website over the past couple of months on a fairly consistent basis, because if we go back, for example, let's take the case of Nikola Tesla back at the turn of the last century. He was involved, as most people are aware, with a project to create wireless transmission of power. In other words, quite literally, broadcasting signals that were not simply communication signals, but actual power without wires. And the plug was pulled, ostensibly, so the story goes, by J.P. Morgan, who, once he learned what Tesla was up to, decided to pull the plug because, the way the story goes, he was concerned that you couldn't meter it, all right? Now, I think that's a cover story, because Morgan stood to gain a lot simply from the royalty and licensing fees on any technology and appliances that would have used that system. The real problem, the way I see it, was that the technology that Tesla was talking about, and he himself acknowledged in a series of short New York Times articles in the 19-teens, that this technology could be weaponized. So I think the
right
problem back then was, well, okay, if we let this out of the bottle, how do we keep track of it? And I strongly suspect that the reason why we have the emphasis from the elite on hot fusion as opposed to cold fusion is that, first of all, it would be a technology that would be comparatively more expensive than cold fusion. And secondly, it would be a much more massive technology. In other words, they could keep track of it. And thirdly, they're letting it out because now they have a global system in place that they can monitor who's doing what with technology. So I totally agree with you on that.
Well, let me turn one of the tremendous focus now with everybody getting smartphones, with the Internet of Things, everything getting wired, everything getting connected. It's kind of frightening. A couple years ago, I rented an apartment here in California for a short period, and I turned on my Wi-Fi, and there were 50 Wi-Fis. Anyway, but we're hearing a lot more about computer-human interfaces. And I think if you look at the technology that's cross-cutting to everything, if we dramatically improve the computer-human interface, we're now talking and watching machines where people can communicate telepathically with thought with computers. You know, what that means is this Internet of Things thing gets turbocharged in ways I can't even imagine.
Yes. Yes. I think this is also part of the agenda, and it's largely, I think, part of the surveillance control agenda, because if you're directly plugged into the Internet via computer-human interfaces, be it through brain implants or some other technology, that this is, in my mind, a scary potential, because there's nothing that would stop them from being able to interfere with a person's emotions, their moods, possibly even their decision-making processes. But I do think this is the other thing, that if implemented, it wouldn't even have to be on a global scale. Let's assume it was implemented simply on a regional scale. That particular region would again experience a dramatic drop in certain prices for energy, labor, and so on. And the other thing it would allow the elite to do was have real-time tracking which they pretty much do now, but this would be a further step in that direction. It would be real-time tracking of spending and saving behavior patterns, investment patterns, and so on and so forth. And
it's the ultimate insider trading machine.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It would be the final step in that ultimate insider trading mechanism.
I was laughing my head off this weekend. I got the New Economist, and first of all, the cover is a picture of a dead bird, and the bird's on a leash, and Angela Merkel is holding the leash, and it's basically saying Europe's economy is dead. That was a little tough. But then I opened it up, and they had an editorial proposing that we needed to be able, government needed to be able to track everybody's, access everybody's GPS information on the cell phone so that we could protect everyone from Ebola.
Oh, geez. Oh, they're milking that one for all it's worth, aren't they?
It's unbelievable. It's, you know, Ebola can solve every problem. Every agenda can be... can be on the Ebola bandwagon here. So,
yep.
but I think the interface question is going to get, you know, the more everything's networked and the more we, the ease of the interface, the more this is going to get truly interesting. I know you and Scott DeHart wrote a book about transhumanism, and maybe you could mention what that is and why it comes up in this context.
Well, transhumanism is this movement of Ray Kurzweil and some others that believe that the human condition is going to be dramatically improved by things like these technological interfaces with computing networks, with artificial intelligence possibly. Other transhumanists are also looking to nanotechnology, implanting little nanobots inside the human body to repair the body at a cellular level. This, in connection with certain genetic therapies, could result in dramatic increases of the human lifespan. And that in itself, if we stop and think about it in terms of its impact on the economy and on finance, that in itself would be a huge additional step in making the economy much more efficient. And the reason I say that is that just stop and consider the educational possibilities alone that this would permit. Right now, we have to recycle all over the world. We have to recycle the sum total of human knowledge every 20 years or so to a new generation. And what this has meant effectively in the past is that our major scientists, for example, are known for maybe one or two major discoveries in their lifetime. Think of Einstein and relativity, or Heisenberg and quantum mechanics and everything that drives our modern world. Well, now let's say that these individuals have a lifespan not of 70, but say of 140 or even 210 years. That would mean that the process of recycling human knowledge would not have to proceed at as fast a pace, and by the same token, it would allow each individual not only to master one particular subject area, but perhaps many subject areas.
And integrate.
And integrate, exactly. And this is going to have a huge multiplier effect on human creativity, on human technological progress. One would hope it would have a similar impact on human spirituality. And I point that out because way, way back in the very first book I wrote in all of this alternative series of research was a book called Giza Death Star. And I pointed out that one of the church fathers, a fellow by the name of John Chrysostom, said that the reason that death occurred for humanity was that it was death that gave individuals the possibility and opportunity for repentance. And what he meant by that is if you can envision a Mother Teresa or an Albert Schweitzer having literally hundreds of years to do their service for humanity that they did, then obviously it would be very beneficial. But by the same token, the flip side is, if you can imagine a Mao Zedong or a Joseph Stalin or an Otto Hitler having hundreds of years to do what they did, then the prospects for monstrousness also are multiplied. So this is another technology, again, that has a double-edged sword to it. And we're going to have to develop the spiritual wherewithal to handle some of these things. That's.
I don't know whether you saw that Elon Musk spoke at MIT and said we should be very wary of artificial intelligence. It was going to let in the demon.
Yes, I actually saw that. I just scheduled a blog about that statement for November 12th. So, yeah, I saw that, and I share his concern, actually.
I do, too. I was like, go, Elon.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
I hope Ray Kurzweil reads this.
Yeah, I hope he does, too.
Because, whenever John Rappaport and I did a Solaria report where we basically got together and did our best to persuade everybody that Kurzweil was completely nuts.
Well, you don't get much of an argument from me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I find fascinating about the developments is these are happening at a very rapid pace, and they're communicated at a very rapid pace because you've basically now got almost everybody, soon to be everybody, on a smartphone. And, one of my big kind of insights that I kept thinking about and talking about when we did the third quarter wrap up was the fact that if you're sitting in a remote village in, you name the continent, but Asia or Latin America, and your teacher and you just want you to learn as best you can, as fast you can, to be as productive you can as to whatever your purpose is, they can now access all the finest curriculum in the world online at relatively inexpensive price. But they're not burdened by the 20,000 to 30,000 hours of curriculum and other requirements and disinformation and testing that you are if you're subject to Common Core in the U.S. educational system,
right.
Which means, the developed world is struggling under a monstrous handicap of tradition and regulation that a lot of the world, Joseph, a lot of the world can just sit down and say, let's learn.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is going to be a huge, and I looked over your email that you sent me prior to this interview. This is going to be a huge change, not only in manufacturing, but in education.
Right.
I think to a certain extent, the technology is simply going to overwhelm the whole Common Core American, the current American system of teacher certification and, spend X numbers of hours in a classroom somewhere. And learn a subject, quote unquote, for 50 minutes and the bell rings and you rush off like Pavlov's dogs to the next class where you learn another subject entirely disconnected from the first.
Well, you can't learn anything in 50 minutes.
Yeah, you cannot.
Yeah.
Integrative learning is going to be, or as I prefer to think of it in terms of an older discipline, it's going to be analogical thinking, interdisciplinary thinking is going to come back, and it's going to come back big time because of this. My only hesitation with the technological force that now seems to be driving education is I am extraordinarily skeptical of having everything in ebook form. And the reason why is if we go back to the old Soviet Union, the old Soviet encyclopedias, which were something of a joke during the Stalin era.
Right.
You'd open up a picture of the encyclopedia in one year and there would be Yezhov and Stalin standing together. And the next year after Yezhov is purged, of course, he's taken out of the picture. All the facts are adjusted accordingly. I think the move to ebooks is a huge mistake because it gives the elite the power to delete or
add. Rewrite everything. They can rewrite everything.
Rewrite everything. Yeah, exactly. So this is the caution that we have to make sure that we understand that there's no substitute for hard copy.
Right.
That's my bottom line on that.
Or I couldn't agree with you more. It's what I occasionally I'll get something on ebook form just because I want to check it out. Or, you know, I wanted to review Cheney's book and I didn't want him to get the satisfaction of me buying a hardback. So. But anything anything that I want to keep, you know, and I want to, you know, I get the hard book. Absolutely.
Right. And the other thing that I think this is going to do, and you suggested this in your email with respect to manufacturing, is you pointed out that, and let me read this here. You pointed out, quote, increasingly the real power of Amazon crowdfunding and eBay models will be recognized as the ability to harness millions of cooperating entities rather than the old hierarchical model of the corporation, just as open source software is done in harnessing of the power of the computer. Well, if we turn the clock back to the Middle Ages and look at the way that corporations functioned then, this was very much their model. They would form limited partnerships for a certain period of time to accomplish certain goals, and once those goals were accomplished, then the partnership was dissolved and they came up with new equity arrangements among the shareholders for the next project. So I think that too is going to drive the way that we organize for economic and productive activity in the future. It's going to become much less, it could become, let me put it this way, much less of the model of the big, huge, global mega corporation dictating everything. I think those things might themselves be overwhelmed by the advance of technology, and different models of corporate cooperation are definitely going to evolve as a result of all of this.
Well, it's funny. We just did a wonderful Salera report on crowdfunding. And had Karen Diggs, who's an entrepreneur, who's had a wildly successful crowdfunding campaign, and in fact ended up at the Maker Faire being highlighted by Kickstarter as one of their most successful entrepreneurs. And I put up a TED speech by Amanda Palmer, who's an performance artist, called The Art of Asking. And what Karen and this wonderful speech by Amanda Palmer are describing, you know, because Wall Street's poo-pooing this and saying, oh, it's tiny dollar. You know, in the last couple of years, it's only been $5 billion, it's tiny dollars. And what they're missing is you're talking about a much more dynamic, intimate relationship between consumer and producer. And it's one that will allow far more producers to operate at much smaller niches. So you're talking about creating economic health for, you know, millions of tiny producers in niche markets. And I just think that intimacy between producer and consumer is going to produce a remarkable number of things. You know, we all I'm beginning to realize around my home, Joseph, I need all these different companies run by small business people to figure out how to protect me and help me deal with corporations.
Yes. You couple this crowdfunding phenomenon with things like niche production and additive manufacturing or 3D printing. And yes, you're going to see a huge, I think personally, you're going to see a huge transformation of manufacturing over the next 20 years. In fact, I've been so fascinated with the subject of 3D printing, I went out and bought a 3D printing software program just to see what you can do with it. And I have to tell you that I'm really, truly astonished at already what has been achieved in terms of computer-aided design and how it would
interface. Oh, it's remarkable.
It is truly remarkable. I don't mind telling you that I'm stunned at what this program can do.
Well, and part of it is that you've gotten, you know, CAD software and 3D software down to something that's so good, but it's so economic. Kids can get on this stuff and start doing it.
Right.
So you're making this stuff much more accessible to the average person, including the average young person.
Well, one of the things that I've encountered as I've been researching this type of software and 3D printing is I run again and again into comments by industrial designers and so on and so forth that are looking at the 3D printers coming out now and being made at low cost so that people can actually put these things in their homes, that some of these designers are saying that they've used these things to prototype their designs for actual products. So in other words, this Right. is the other thing that manufacturing is going to encounter, is you're going to have a lot of prototyping being done, you know, just by people in their homes. And this is going, again, to dramatically change the nature of manufacturing, because Gertrude in her garage may have a prototype for a certain part, for a certain piece of equipment, that works better than anything that a major corporation can do. And this is going to dramatically influence not only the patent industry and patent law, it's going to dramatically influence manufacturing as well. You're going to have all sorts of people involved with this. So things are dramatically changing.
Right. I knew something was up when, I think it was 2 years ago, I put the article up on the blog. The patent office announced that it was creating regional patent offices. I said, oh, this is a very good sign.
Yes, it is. Because it's a clear response to precisely these trends that we're talking about in manufacturing with crowdfunding, 3D printing, and so on. It's a clear response to that. So, you know, it's already transforming the world we live in, but, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet.
So I want to jump back to do some energy things, because I want to talk a little bit about solar. I just was reading an article about, apparently the Waltons have a big investment in First Solar, and First Solar has been lobbying to stop certain rules that some say would allow the innovation of solar to grab on. But there's a real... You know, there's kind of a real positioning between different players and trying to grab the solar market share as it starts to get much more economic. We're watching the cost of the panels come down. Okay. One of my partners says it's a little bit like the semiconductor industry where the curve is coming down. Yep. But the other thing is the battery technology is improving.
Oh,
and I think I don't understand a lot about the battery technology, but I understand it's part of what, you know, is going to get solar really competitive with the cost of coal to the utilities that are providing the electricity. And so I don't know what you know about battery technology, but maybe we could just touch on that for a second and what it could literally do to your home.
Well, one of the things that's happening, and I'm glad you mentioned battery technology and solar and all of that, one of the things that's happening in physics is they are now realizing that the idea of quote-unquote room temperature superconductors is becoming closer to reality. Now, a superconductor, if people don't know what that is simply a device where, usually in a ring, where you cool it down to near absolute zero and load it with an electric current. Well, near absolute zero, resistance approaches zero. So the electric current just stays inside the superconductor, whirling around at incredible speeds with very little loss of power. Now, if you can bring that phenomenon up to closer to quote-unquote room temperature and have the same phenomenon work, then the battery, the capacitor technology will improve dramatically, because this would mean that you could store current with very, very little loss over time at relatively much easier to engineer temperatures. So they've been bringing the threshold of the superconducting phenomenon up. Now, the thing to note here, what we're talking about, is that these technologies in and of themselves are not a big deal. It's when you combine them with other technologies, superconducting and batteries, superconducting batteries and solar panels, superconducting batteries and fusion, and those in turn with transportation propulsion systems, and on we could go. So in other words, it's not only in the advent of new technologies that we're watching things being driven at speeds that we scarcely could have imagined 10 to 20 years ago, but it's in the combinations of those technologies
right.
with each other that we're seeing things happening at an extremely accelerated pace. And this is going to keep continuing. I mean, my word, like I said, in the next 100 to 200 years, human society is going to dramatically transform itself at every level, from transportation to labor and energy costs. Everything is going to change significantly.
Well, what this means is it should dramatically reduce the cost of heating and providing the energy for a home.
Absolutely. Because the other thing implicit in these technologies, too, which is one reason I think that we also see the rush to put in the global surveillance system, is that with these kinds of technologies, it becomes very conceivable to envision Tesla's old dream of not having a wired together network, a grid. So in other words, people will be, quote unquote, off the grid, so to speak. You'll be powering your home. You'll be making your home with 3D printing.
Well, there's an extraordinary effort, from what I can tell, all across the nation to institute regulations which basically require you to keep paying the utilities, you know, whether you need them or not anymore.
Right.
And
right.
to rig in the monopoly before this all rolls out.
Yeah, I think you're seeing that happen. I think it's going to fail because, again, I think the technology is simply going to overwhelm the regulatory system. It's the same
I have
problem.
To make a cartoon of Bill Gates being overwhelmed by feeding technology.
Exactly.
So let me
ask you, go ahead.
You're the one guy who could explain the particle accelerator at CERN. Explain
yes.
to us what that is and
okay.
why it's important.
The CERN accelerator is called the Large Hadron Collider, and it's very important in my mind, and I hope people understand, I'm not a credentialed scientist, I'm a hack from South Dakota. So, you know, my opinion here is that of a rank amateur. You know, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a particle physicist or anything remotely close to it, but the Hadron Collider was built precisely in order to find certain particles that were predicted in the standard model of quantum mechanics, things like the Higgs boson and some other particles. And this is the reason for its enormous size and its enormous energy. The interesting thing is that CERN appears both to have announced and then retracted and then obfuscated whether or not it has in fact found the Higgs boson. This is a very murky area as far as I can tell. And you recall that when the collider was turned on initially a couple years ago, they shut it down right away because they claimed that a tear had occurred in one of the big helium cooling rings around these gigantic magnetic rings in the accelerator. And I've always been suspicious of that explanation, Catherine. The bottom line is that they are not finding the particles that the standard model predicted in the numbers that they should be finding them by now. So what it indicates to me is possibly that, and there's some scientists that have already admitted this and have gone back to the drawing board and are talking about truly radical things like throwing out dimensionality from their equations altogether, which, you know, when I read this, I was just sort of gobsmacked because the equations of theoretical physics, beginning with general relativity, are all based in some form of dimensional analysis. Einstein put his equations in four dimensions and so on and so forth. So the idea of getting rid of it altogether, I'm just thinking, my word, you know, is it that bad? So they didn't find what they were looking for, and I suspect that the real story when they turned the thing on and then turned it off so quickly, I suspect strongly that they found something anomalous that didn't fit the model, and it's forcing them to rethink things. Now, the reason I think that is that the Chinese have recently announced that they want to build their own version of it, and even bigger. And what that's telling me is they don't trust the information coming out of CERN. So they're going to build one and figure out what the heck is going on and see for themselves. So the Hadron Collider, I'm very skeptical of pronouncements coming out of CERN right now. There's been too much obfuscation of the data, and now with this business of some physicists wanting to rethink literally everything, that tells me something's afoot.
Well, there's a lot afoot. You know, one of the things I didn't mention earlier when you brought up Lockheed,
yes,
I think a lot of the people listening don't understand how important Lockheed may be. Lockheed is the number one contractor to the U.S. government, both defense and domestic. And it's fair to say, you know, I think of Lockheed in certain areas as being far more powerful than the U.S. government, but they also have been one of the real leaders in the black budget area, Area 51, all of the, you know, so if anybody's reverse engineering this kind of technology, UFO technology, Lockheed has been the leader in that. So,
oh, yes, absolutely.
And this quote came from somebody at Skunk Works, which is the, you know, the area dealing with the UFO technology at Lockheed, I'm assuming. So we're talking about coming from someone who's had access to extraordinary technology for quite some time.
What quotation are you referring to?
The one when they announced the fusion.
Oh.
It was mentioned that the fellow worked at the Skunk Works.
Yes. Well, yeah, Lockheed and the Skunk Works and the black budget, this is another huge story. We touched upon it quite a lot at the Secret Space Conference. My favorite quotation from Lockheed and the Skunk Works is from the former head of the Skunk Works, the late Ben Rich, who gave several talks after he had retired from Lockheed to his fellow engineers. And he said some truly astonishing things. One of the things he said was, we found an error in the equations, and now we can take E.T. home. And, you know, when I read that, the first time I read it, was my reaction was, well, whose equations?
Maybe that's what they're rediscovering at CERN.
Well, exactly. You know, that's exactly where I was going with it. You know, the whole idea of getting rid of dimensionality in mathematical physics is to me just breathtaking. The other thing is, okay, well, so we have the ability to take E.T. home. So where's home, you know? How long does it take to get there, you know?
That leads us, I'm going to get back to space travel in a second, but that leads us to the idea of terraforming.
Yes.
Because one of the things that I'll email back and forth with you is this concept we have, that we can make a planet hospitable with terraforming. Although, you know, it's interesting. I just had dinner with a lovely person who said to me when I asked him what he thought the chemtrails was, he said he thought we were terraforming Earth to make it hospitable to non-humans.
Or inhospitable to non-humans.
Who knows? We're willing.
Yeah. that one I think could go either way. But yes.
Yeah.
Let's look at the possibilities here with the new energy technologies that are beginning to be talked about, with DARPA's pronouncement that they want the United States to be warp capable in 100 years. Well, as I put it in the Secret Space Conference, DARPA doesn't make announcements like that without having done some preliminary proof of concept experiments secretly. So in other words, they're hopeful enough that they can do this in that amount of time. And of course, that implies that they've got some sort of long-term black budget project lined up to do precisely that. So how does terraforming fit in? Well, it fits in very easily. If you've got the energy capabilities that fusion might bring and make available, then the engineering, if you've got nanotechnology, robotics, additive manufacturing, and so on, developed to the point that you can remotely and robotically begin to terraform planets, then the sky's the limit. In other words, it opens up, to my mind, it opens up absolutely cosmic vistas of engineering. And, you know, the thing that people have to get out of their heads with some of these UFOs, well, they're so gigantic they couldn't possibly be human. Well, my response is nonsense. If you are capable of engineering systems on planetary or even stellar scales, which we already have the ability to do with things like HARP and ionic spheric heaters, engineer weather, which is a planetary scaled system,
right,
then the idea of terraforming becomes very, very possible. So, again, I you know, the sky is the limit here, really. And I know it sounds like we're talking science fiction, but in reality, these are the technologies that are coming online, and these are their potential implications.
See, I don't think we're talking about science fiction, because I think so much effort has been made over the last 50 years
yes.
to keep the general public in the dark.
Yes.
So if you look at what was going on in the black budget 50 years ago, or 60
yes.
years ago, it makes sense that we would be 60 years beyond where we were.
Well, yes. Now, let's take two examples of what you're talking about here. The Nazi Bell, which is a story that I've been investigating for a number of years, which supposedly was this technology that the Nazis came up with in World War II that actually levitated, all right? In other words, this device just floated right up off the ground. It was a kind of primitive field propulsion machine. Well, the story goes that they were doing this, accomplishing this feat in 1944. Then you have the American inventor, a well-known physicist in the alternative research community by the name of Thomas Townsend Brown, who was performing experiments with what he called gravitors or gravitators back in the 20s and 30s, 1920s and 30s, charging up these dielectrical components, and they would lift. And he performed this test in France after the Second World War in vacuum. So in other words, this was not due to ionic wind or any of the nonsense that you often hear attributed. This was a true field propulsion capability. And again, these demonstrations he conducted in the 1950s. So stop and think here, folks, and put it in the context of Ben Rich's statements, the Lockheed Skunk Works. From the 1950s until now, you would have had a vast commitment of personnel. You would have had a vast financial commitment in the trillions of dollars over several decades. So in other words, what could they have accomplished from those faltering beginnings during the Second World War and after up until today? And when you think of it that way, then yeah, you might be dealing with a technological capability secretly that exists far in excess of what's known publicly. I think what we're really looking at, in other words, with the memes that are being pushed of these energy developments and 3D printing and tractor beams and all of this stuff that they're talking about publicly, I think the secret capability of these technologies already far exceeds what they're releasing. They're preparing us, in other words, for huge cultural and social transformation.
Right. It's interesting. I used to work as a maitre d'. I used to be in the restaurant business when I was in college and going to school. And if it was 30 minutes for a table, I'd always tell them it was 45 or an hour, because there's nothing more frustrating than a person whose blood sugar is low and you've given them the wrong estimate. So whenever DARPA says 100 years, I see myself saying, oh, it's an hour for a table.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly my thinking, too. I actually, as I put it in the San Mateo conference, I think that announcement was on the conservative side.
Yes.
They deliberately did that because, again, I don't think that they would make these kinds of announcements without having run privately and secretly some proof of concept experiments that indicated to them the feasibility of the idea. So again, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, but the point is that they are pushing these things in the public eye right now. And over time, these capabilities will improve and so on. And I suspect a lot of it will simply be deliberately leaked. I've thought this about 3D printing for some time, that this is, and it is known that 3D printing has been around for quite a while, but it's been
right.
So costly and in use in various large corporations for so long. But ultimately, I think it comes out of the Black Project's world, and that the actual capability is far beyond what we
right. I think we're seeing the reverse engineering of a lot of the stuff that's been reverse engineering now
it
coming to the fore.
It could be. I've always taken the tack. You know, I get that reverse engineering a lot as, well, couldn't the Nazis have come up with their Bell idea by reverse engineering, you know, a crashed UFO? Well, sure they could, but there's not a great deal of evidence that they did. I think
right.
When you look at the physics papers and engineering papers between the wars, it's very clear that some people are already thinking along these lines, you know, with just good old human ingenuity. So, you know, put all that ingenuity in a Black Projects world for 50 years and give it trillions of dollars.
So that's what's it, right. It's important to understand that people working in these areas report that their resources are infinite. You know, it's all the money you want.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, give them all that money and let scientists do what every scientist really wants to do, and that's invent something wild and crazy. You know?
So I wanted to bring up holograms for a second because,
sure.
You know, I did a couple of interviews where I said, look, I don't know what's going on in the airspace around us, but what I know is if you add up the cost of all the hardware, it's more than what the industrial plant that we can see and know about can produce. It just,
right.
You know, the two do not balance. So I had a lovely and very intelligent subscriber write in and say, oh, well, they're all holograms. So I was wondering maybe if you could say a little bit about hologram technology. What is it? Why is it important? What's going on there?
Well, holograms are very unique. As most people know, they're done with lasers. And the interesting thing about a hologram is it's a three dimensional image that you can literally clip if you have a hologram imprinted on, let's say, a piece of metal or something. You can literally snip off a little piece of that metal, and the entire hologram will be present in the piece of metal that you snip off. This is a really intriguing thing about them. In other words, they have an almost 100% preservation of information in toto, both in the total hologram and in any of its pieces. That's one of the very intriguing things about it. But the interesting thing about holograms, there's been an important development. I'm so glad you raised this. There's been an important development in hologram technology that was announced in the last week by researchers.
Really?
By researchers in Japan. Now, sit down and hold on, because is they've been able to make holograms that are responsive to touch. You can actually take your fingers. They've had holograms of little bouncing balls that you can flick with your finger, and the ball will bounce or split apart into more balls and so on and so forth. So in other words, they're able now to program holograms with three-dimensional responses to the environment around them. you know, that's a huge leap, because if this is the case, then it's a step away from going back to our Star Trek replicator idea and 3D printing. It's a step away from actually being able to say, well, can we make a hologram and 3D print it simply through the manipulation of photons and electromagnetic energy? In other words, can we convert it into an actual object? So in other words, we've taken another little step on the technology tree to all of those wild and woolly science fiction things that we watched back in the 1980s.
Right. Well, wasn't it, didn't Wernher von Braun tell Carol or someone that they were going to use hologram technology to stage the, you know, the alien invasion?
Well, he didn't exactly say that. What he said to Dr. Rosen, I'm assuming that you're referring to her von Braun affidavit that she released back in the late 1980s. What von Braun told her was that there would be a certain progression for the argument to weaponize space, to put weapons in space. And the first stage in that process would be the communists, and then the next stage would be, interestingly enough, terrorists. And then the next stage would be asteroids, and then the final stage, he said, that we would be using as a justification for weaponizing space would be extraterrestrials. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really touch upon holograms. There is a school of thought out there. I'm not a subscriber to it, but there's a school of thought out there that says, yes, they can stage all of this by projecting holograms in the atmosphere. That would be extremely complicated to do. You'd have to use things like optical phase conjugation and so on and so forth to do it, but it's at least theoretically conceivable. It would require an enormous amount of energy. But
one of my favorite science fiction books, I love William Gibson, was Mona Lisa Overdrive. And in Mona Lisa Overdrive, one of the stories is there is a young girl who's Japanese. Her father is a Yakuza boss. And he sends her to London to keep her safe. And he gives her a digital personal assistant, this little digital tool, and inside of it is a hologram that pops out. It's a British butler, dressed, you know, perfectly with a British accent. It pops out as a hologram, and it can answer any question and do anything you need.
Right. Well,
and I remember reading it and saying, I want one of those.
Yeah, that's not far off, in my opinion.
Right.
I mean, if the Japanese are producing environmentally responsible holograms already, then...
well, you notice you and I got a big chuckle when the Japanese came out and said they were going to cut back on semiconductors and start manufacturing more for space. Remember?
Yep.
Including the space elevator. They'd have a space elevator up by 2050. Of course, the Japanese talk a lot about doing solar plants in space, capturing in these giant solar farms that are in space and then deliver the energy back here on Earth.
Yeah,
so
that's another interesting story. And let me comment on that one, because I followed that one rather closely on the blog site. The Japanese first came out and said that they wanted to put solar panels around the equator of the moon.
Really? I didn't see that one.
Oh, yes. I blogged about that a few months ago. And I thought, gee, you know, they're going to beam all this microwave power back to Earth. And I thought, well, you know, the U.S. Air Force had this project in the 1960s that I talk about in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, where they wanted to do the same thing, just put up big satellites, collect all this microwave power from the sun, beam it to the Earth in the form of microwaves, and use that as a power source. The problem was that the microwave collectors here on Earth would literally toast the region of about 140 square miles, where, you know, nothing living could live in these microwave collection areas. So the Japanese want to do this with the moon. And I thought, well, gee, you know, that's what they really are saying is we want to turn the moon into a Death Star. And sure enough, within about 3 days, China responded to that story by saying, oh yeah, you know, let's put up a bunch of solar panels on the moon and turn it into a Death Star. So in other words, the Chinese weren't fooled. And the Japanese then switched the idea from the moon to orbiting satellites to do the same thing. Well, in other words, what they're talking about, folks, is
weapons. Space weapons. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, space weapons is a, I mean, the challenge of all of these technologies, or many of these technologies, is they can be used for good and they can be used for evil. And I think the hard thing in contemplating any of them is you look at some of the more gruesome aspects or applications, and it really does get kind of scary.
Oh, yes.
I wanted to talk about something that's less exciting, but I think it's going to have a big impact, and that's what some people call big data, moving data into the cloud.
Yes.
We're literally watching, it's not a nice process, but we're watching a process both using economics as well as a whole world of dirty tricks to force everybody to keep their databases in big server farms called the cloud.
Yeah.
But what this does do is this gives the ability to integrate and develop and do all sorts of applications because you have access to the information. So if you have everybody's health information in digital databases and it's all sucking into one big, combination of databases that can be mined and harvested relationally, you know, the sky's the limit. I always tell people I'm out here in Silicon Valley right now and, you know, they're planning on re-engineering $1.6 trillion out of labor costs in healthcare.
Yes.
Once they get their hands on all this data. So we're seeing a wide number of applications in many fields. But maybe if you could talk a little bit about big data and what it means.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, again, I'm very skeptical of moving. In fact, I keep all of my data on my personal computer, right here on my computer, and back it up on disks. I don't use
clouds.
Right.
Right.
What this represents to me is what we talked about before. This will give them, you know, we think of the current NSA spying program as being the ultimate insider trading mechanism. Well, like we said before, you ain't seen nothing yet, because if you have all this data moving to the cloud, then what it gives the elite who control the actual computers that all of this data is on, it gives them a huge advantage in terms of market manipulation, in terms of watching real-time financial transactions. I mean, think of SWIFT and add to that everybody posting their data, be it creative data, be it financial data, be it their online purchases and what have you. Think of all of that added to this, and it gives them an enormous capability to manipulate markets, to plan responses to public opinion, to drive public opinion. Again, this is going to have, it's going to have just an enormous effect, Catherine, on our culture. And this is why I say if you really want to store your data, buy the hard copy. You know, if you're buying
right. Ebooks,
shift to books, because the hard copy is the testament. And even more, something that bothers me, Catherine, and this will hit home with you from your background, is this idea that we see happening in this country where mortgage titles are being moved into an electronic database form. And the opportunities there, for one thing, for fraud on an enormous scale is magnified.
Mind-boggling.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, mind-boggling.
And the other thing that happens as a result of this, as we're discovering from various localities around the country, is that when these systems are implemented and you move all of this mortgage data into the cloud, then local governments begin to lose revenue from the fees that they charge on registration of deeds and titles and so on. So this is, in my opinion, another strike against localities, and they're trying to drive this because, as you suggested before, the technology itself tends to be localizing and decentralizing. So they're pushing this move as, in my opinion, a counter to these trends that are emerging from the technology. They want to move everything into these electronic databases, and my response is, don't let them do it. You know,
I have to tell you just a. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I have to tell you just a little tidbit I discovered today. One of our latest Elyria reports is called Successful Home Buying. And I was able to interview sort of really the top writer on, you know, how to go about buying a home is quite extraordinary. Somebody with very deep knowledge. And in one of his books, he was pointing out that you have to, you know, it's a very niche thing and you have to make sure you know what the market in the neighborhood is doing vis-a-vis other neighborhoods. Now, I don't know if you remember Gary Webb's Dark Alliance, but there's one point where Ricky Ross, who's dealing all the drugs in South Central LA, has just millions of dollars of cash under his bed, and he doesn't know what to do with it. And somebody says, oh, my God, you don't know? You buy real estate. So Ross goes out, and of course, it was the thing that started me on the pathway I'm on now was we were publishing maps that showed the defaulted FHA mortgages in South Central LA. And, you know, it scared some the bejesus out of a whole bunch of people because they were using the mortgages to launder the money and to lever the fraud. Because with mortgage fraud, you can turn, you know, $100,000 of drug profits can turn into $1 million of fraudulent Ginnie Mae securities. So anyway.
Yep.
So I'm reading this book and it says, you know, for example, in the early 90s with the California recession, Beverly Hills real estate was down 20 or 30%, but South Central LA was up.
Oh my word.
And you know, clearly he had no idea what he was saying.
Oh,
it was quite, I know it was well, you never know. There it is, another nugget. So
yeah,
let me turn to
sure.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to turn to robotics.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I try regularly to follow what's going on in robotics and the adoption of robotics. And, of course, for me, one of the most interesting questions about robotics is if we go through this next round of automation that's expected with digital technology in healthcare and then do robotics, particularly in the retail sectors, what's it going to do to incomes? You know, incomes have been steadily falling in part because of automation. But,
yes.
You know, I have to confess to you, Joseph, when I get online and I watch these different robotic soldiers or, you know, I just think, oh, my God, between the drones and the robotic soldiers, what in the world is life on planet Earth going to be like?
Well, it's going to be hideous if they don't build in safeguards. I mean, you know, it's not only robotic soldiers we have to worry about. I'll go even further. It's robotic police. It's robotic medical professionals. Imagine nurses being replaced with robots. In other words, you will take this vaccine now, you know, and
right.
So on and so forth. It's the ultimate goal of Common Core, in my opinion, is to offshore the teaching profession. You know, it's a huge strike against the teachers' unions and so on and so
right.
forth. And ultimately turn them into nothing more than classroom monitors to make sure everybody's watching their computer screens properly and
right.
filling out answers to tests. And ultimately that could be replaced with a robot. So in other words, the emergence of robots is to me one of the most disturbing trends technologically that we have coming down the pike. It could end up with a truly Orwellian state of culture and society, ultimately dehumanizing state of culture and society. I think again the solution here is that people have to understand that these technologies, like or not, are coming down the line, and they have
right.
to insist on adequate safeguards. You know, we're right back with the advent of robotics. We're right back to Isaac Asimov's novel I, Robot. You know, it was popularized
right.
in the movie with Will Smith, that they had to build in programming safeguards into these machines that, you know, under no circumstances will they harm a human being and so on and so forth, and all the complications that gives. So that's one development I think that's more than the others a potential negative in all of this technology coming to
I must tell you, my favorite science fiction program on robotics is Battlestar Galactica, when the robots just get together and say, let's destroy the humans.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, and that could happen.
Yeah, that could happen.
I think that's part of what Musk is saying with this demon.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do, too. It's present danger.
But here's the question. If chemtrails is full of these little particles, metallic particles that can turn us into transistors, and everyone's got a device full of entrainment and is getting filled with vaccines to make them easy to entrain, which one are you more afraid of, entrained humans or robots?
I'm actually more afraid of entrained humans.
Me too.
The reason being that humans, I have this theory that, the human person, the human mind and memory is actually a non-local phenomenon. In other words, it's not entrapped in our bodies.
Right.
Our bodies.
It's in the field.
It's in the field. And our bodies are kind of act like radio transmitters that are tuned to a certain thing. And that means that you can never, like it or not, by any technological means, completely eradicate that individual divine spark or whatever you wish to say. But you can certainly pervert it. You can certainly influence it to such a degree that it would, an individual will start doing things that they normally wouldn't do. And that's what I find very frightening. And I agree with you about the spraying, the metallic particles and so on, because I have a friend that suffers from the disease that doesn't exist, Morgellons disease. And he has had those lesions examined by a pathologist in a laboratory. And what she discovered was that these lesions were full of plastic crystals that were growing like little antennas in these lesions.
Right.
And the interesting thing is when the electromagnetic garbage in the air is particularly intense, on those days, he can feel it because the pain of those lesions increases dramatically. So, yeah, I think we're looking at huge entrainment technologies there that we have to be extraordinarily skeptical of.
Right, right. It's my favorite. I've told you this. One of my favorite moments with when the Solari report was with Dr. Gwen Scott, who's an expert on Magellan's disease, and I had reorganized our briefing into my proposal for what we would do, the 10 action steps you can take to protect yourself against chemtrails. And she listened to me very politely, and she said, well, dear, you forgot the most important one. And I said, what's that? And she said, Grace, you know, if you look at what's been going on, we should be dead, but we're not. So something else is happening.
I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. There is a spiritual component in all of this that that seems to be entering the field, and it does seem to be blocking a lot of these attempts. This is why I keep telling people, you know, if you're the praying sort, pray against some of these phenomena that are of concern to you. And if you're not the praying sort, then think about it, you know. But put the intentionality out there, because there is an underlying, if you will, spiritual or physical medium that isn't part of the material world.
Right.
Quantum mechanics tells us as much. And quantum mechanics also tells us that much of physics is observer-based. In other words, you cannot measure, to put it in the most simple terms, you cannot measure the position and momentum of an electron at the same time. So you predetermine the outcome of an experiment before you actually perform it, depending on what you're looking for.
Right.
And this is, you know, this has led to all sorts of philosophical conundrums within the realm of physics. But the basic bottom line here is that there is a correspondence between human intention and physical reality. And you've talked with Dr. William Tiller, I know, on your show many times. And he's documented the same type of thing, and in response to material effects of intention, Dr. Emoto in Japan, who recently passed, unfortunately, but he...
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he recently passed away. But he did all sorts of work on the same sort of area. So it's a very, very important thing. And I do agree with you. I think there's a certain amount of what Western theology would call grace.
I'm always telling people, don't worry about getting away from the bad guys. Worry about getting under that grace.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So there are a few other developments I want to pick your big brain on. Cities, mega cities. There is no doubt we are moving more and more people into these huge 10 million more megacities. And yet the technology to make it possible for us to share and, you know, share cars and share stuff, you know, share lawnmowers, everything is exploding. So tell us what you think about cities and architecture and megacities.
Oh, boy. That's a really good one, and I have to be honest, I'm torn. Part of me looks at the technology and the way the elite seems to be driving things, and it does seem that they want to concentrate as much of the population of the world as they can into these big, huge cities, and even in China's case, these big, huge, self-contained arcologies, these huge buildings, that each building is kind of a little city unto itself. The idea of arcologies actually comes out of an Italian architect back in the 1970s or 80s. I forget what his name was right off the top of my head, but he actually published a whole book of these big, huge buildings that were self-contained cities. And he coined the term arcology. But I actually see another trend here that is possible, and that is that the technology that we see already, that's already out there and available, makes the human requirement for big cities obsolescent. I look at the big megalopolises, you know, Los Angeles, the Los Angeles-San Diego corridor, Houston, Chicago, these big, huge cities. And they really are obsolescent response to a 20th century model of manufacturing and distribution of goods and so on. We don't need them anymore. In other words, we can have a much more dispersed population over a much wider area. And I think technology may drive things in that direction. So again, you know, the response of the elites is to try and force people into bigger and bigger cities, when in fact the actual drive of the technology, to me, seems to be implying that we should do the exact opposite. You know, I lead pretty much a self-contained life. I do most of my shopping and so on for my books online, and I don't go out that much to bookstores or things like that. And there's nothing I can do in a big city that I couldn't do in Spearfish, South Dakota.
Right.
In that respect. And I think a lot of people are going to find themselves in that position, even more so as 3D printing and some of these ideas come online. And let me add one more thing to that consideration. And that's the military way of looking at things. Let's go back to the period of the mid-40s. Let's go back to about 1943 during World War II, when the Allied bombing campaign over Germany is reaching its height. Well, what was Albert Speer's response as armaments minister to the bombing campaign? Well, the first thing he did was he dispersed manufacturing. He localized it. And he took a lot of manufacturing out of the big industrialized areas like the Ruhr and so on, and dispersed all of it all over Germany, and many times in underground factories. And then he instituted modular building processes, so that by the end of the war, the Germans were actually producing terribly advanced submarines, their Type 21 submarines, modularly inland. And then they would simply ship the parts of the submarine to a port facility where they'd be welded together, and off they go. They were doing this with tanks, they were, you know, doing it with aircraft, everything. So that by the height of the Allied bombing campaign in 1944, that was also the height of German war production during the war. So in other words, I think that 3D manufacturing, one reason that they are pushing the meme of getting everybody into 3D printing is I'm looking at it from the military point of view. What does that do? Well, it disperses manufacturing, and therefore it becomes much more difficult to target for a potential enemy, be that enemy on-world or, for that matter, off-world. So it
Right.
could be that we are looking at a different push by the elite, and that may be to get people out of the big cities and into more smaller towns and villages and so on in order to disperse any potential targets. And the key there is to keep the communications networks open. You pointed out recently Warren Buffett buying railroads and so on. And that may be a real clue as to what's going on.
Well, there's no doubt about it. If you look at the effort to bring manufacturing back, plus do the 3D, the combination is you're building a manufacturing and industrial juggernaut. And it's very decentralized, and it's very redundant. It's very innovative. It's very flexible. And, you know, and you add to that all the spaceports they're building around the country, and you're beginning to see quite a base for a push into space. It's what it looks like to me. Okay, so I just have to quickly ask you, maglev trains, high-speed trains, we now see the Chinese proposing to to build a train all the way to the United States.
Right.
Underground trains, the Japanese saying they'll help finance it. Are we going to get finally high-speed trains above ground?
That's a catchy question. that's a trick question. I think ultimately you're going to have some sort of energy efficient ground-based mass transportation system, simply because with this dispersed manufacturing base, you're going to have the ability to move lots of material very quickly from one region to another. Now, the catch here is above ground. That I don't know, because for the Chinese plan to be practical, it will have to be underground, obviously, underneath the ocean at some point.
Right.
And that, to me, makes sense, particularly, again, from a military point of view. If you have all of this moving underground, then it becomes a much more difficult situation from a military standpoint to interdict any of that. So I'm thinking, we're going to see some sort of mass transportation, but the other thing I'm thinking that we're going to see come down the line as possible technologies and investment opportunities is a tremendous public expansion of the knowledge of the underground drilling technologies that they already have available.
Right.
Not to mention a huge expansion in the capability of those technologies. Let me give you an example. The old method of drilling a tunnel was to take these big machines with their diamond head cutters and literally chew their way through a bunch of rock, and then the slag would be conveyor belted out the rear and hauled off by dump trucks. The current boring technology that is probably in use in the black projects world, and other countries have this, the Germans certainly do, is a plasma boring machine, which uses a nuclear reactor literally to melt their way through the rock and quite literally just kind of vaporize it. And what this does is, as they melt their way through the rock, as it cools, hardens into this kind of green glaze in many cases. And that actually strengthens the tunnel. That hard glaze becomes a very, very hard surface that is much more capable of supporting the weight of a much larger tunnel. So I think if they're going to do this maglev business, it's going to be in conjunction with some boring technology that will begin to make its way into the public eye in a major way that we're not seeing happen yet, but eventually I think it will.
Right. Eventually it means the public's going to realize, you know, there's been quite an infrastructure investment. It's just not been one they've seen.
Right, exactly. And to be very frank, you know, maglev technology has been around for quite some time.
For a long, long time.
A long, long time, as has this boring technology. So I suspect, like many people out there, that there is already a hidden rail network of some sort underground between the various defense installations and corporations involved with black projects. In fact, there are stories out there, if you research them, to the effect that they've had these tunnel systems for quite some time between, you know, Area 51 and Hellendale, California, and various places in the Midwest connected with this secret research. So it wouldn't surprise me to see that we're going to see
right.
more of that go public.
Two of the little more out there technologies before I end. I want to talk about the financial system and end on that. But two other sort of out there. One, of course, is portals. You open the door on Earth and step through the door and you're on the moon.
Yeah.
Is it feasible?
Well, that's iffy. In the standard model, a wormhole is subject to what's called the Schwarzschild limit. And basically, to put it country simple, what that means is that a wormhole is a billion times tinier than tiny. And it requires an enormous amount of energy, an energy requirement that we can't, at least publicly, meet. And it would be so tiny that it would be impossible to send objects through it. You'd have to send information through it and then reassemble it Star Trek replicator-like on the other end. So I think we're a long way off from being able to do that. Now, that said, that's just the standard model. In my book, Secrets of the Unified Field, and the subtitle is the Philadelphia Experiment, the Nazi Bell, and the Discarded Theory, I pointed out a paper by some American physicists and engineers whose last names are Corum, C-O-R-R-U-M, and Daum, D-A-U-M, that pointed out that within the idea of torsion rather than wormholes, you might be able, just possibly, to get some sort of teleportation effect on a large object, not subject to the Schwarzschild limit, by way of a phenomenon of resonance. And again, that would require enormous amounts of energies, but it would at least allow you the possibility of sending objects through something like that. So that's the alternative fringe area of physics. I tend to be currently skeptical of stories out there that you step into this chamber here and you walk out of the chamber on Mars. But again, you know, we're dealing with the Black Projects world, and people like Ben Rich and others have said we have things in the Nevada desert that would make George Lucas envious. So who knows?
Who knows? Okay, time travel.
Right.
Time travel. Do they have it?
Time travel. Do we have it? Let me give the background before I give my answer. Time travel is, in my mind, intimately related to the possibility that, again, you can go online at phys.org and pull up papers that talk about temporal cloaking of little micro events. In other words, what they've done is they've taken certain things, events, and literally cloaked them, removed them from a little local time stream. Okay. Now, this has been done. It's already been done on the laboratory bench. So, in other words, what they're telling you is we have the capability to engineer the fabric of space-time on the laboratory bench. Okay.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a big, huge one. And the same thing, if you stop and think about it, is true with any sort of invisibility technology. In other words, if something is rendered invisible, then you are removing it from a person's ability to react to it in the environment. In other words, you are already influencing the time stream. You're influencing the decision-making processes involved in the time stream. So do they have that sort of capability and technology? With those caveats in mind, my answer would be yes.
Mm. Well, it's certainly, it's the one technology I have trouble envisioning.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to envision it. Time travel in the sense that most people think of traveling backwards in the past or forwards into the future, that's not really what I'm talking about here. But it's the fact that we're already doing this is kind of, again, the first step in the technology tree that might eventually lead to that possibility.
Right. Okay, so we come out of the bailouts in 2009, and, you know, I'm subject to a whole world of financial people who keep saying, oh, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. And the Fed starts to print enormous amounts of money, and everyone's saying, oh, well, they can't do this, we'll have hyperinflation. But of course we're not, because we're securitizing the whole planet. All that money is being spread over a much wider asset base. And this kind of technology is steadily being introduced. New technology is very deflationary. So whether it's the deflation of globalizing labor or deflation of new technology or simply the enormous capacity to soak up money of literally bringing the entire planet into the securitization process,
right.
You know, we're going into a, you know, this is an unprecedented change. We've never had anything like this. And once you securitize the whole planet and flip the currency model, you know, I'm assuming it won't happen again, at least for another 500 years. So this is, as Ed Sullivan used to say, this is really, really big.
Yes.
And yet I'm surrounded by financial people who keep predicting the, you know, the collapse of the dollar and the collapse of the economy.
Right.
And I despair for explaining to them, you know, you don't understand. We had a coup. They won. They're reinvesting trillions of dollars in the most advanced technology in the world and completely reinventing the whole planet.
Right.
So right. You see that. Why can't I explain that to...
Well, I have the same difficulty, Catherine, and you and I have discussed this. I've discussed this with some other people. I go back to... I can go all the way back to Richard Nixon taking us off of Bretton Woods. And I recall that even then, there were the financial analysts that were predicting the sky is going to fall any day now because of this. They were predicting the same thing under Reagan, or we're going to have hyperinflation, the dollar is going to collapse, you know, on and on. I've heard this for 40 years. You know, like it's like predicting the rapture, you know. It's the Chicken Little syndrome, you know. And my bottom line is this. When I look at people like that, I can think of certain financial advisors, and I'm sure you can too. I won't mention names, but that appear to be looking at the picture from an incredibly narrow database, be it bullion prices or the amount of quantitative easing that's taken place, the amount of dollars in circulation, the amount of U.S. securities held by foreign governments, what have you. They're looking at such a narrow database. And I have to be honest, I've never talked with any of these people. I don't encounter them in my work. So I don't know how my proposal would work with them. But it seems to me that what they have to understand is that, first of all, their theories and their models are based on forms of economics and finance modeling that are at best 19th century. In their origins. In other words, they're trying to apply Industrial Revolution principles to what's going on now, and it simply isn't working. And
right.
At some point, they have to be made to realize, well, if your model has been predicting this collapse for these particular reasons that go all the way back to Bretton Woods and Ronald Reagan and what have you, then maybe it's time that they reexamine the assumptions of their model.
Well, there's something else in that. You know, at the Secret Space Program, I always recommend that people, we've got the videos now up on the blog, you've got them in your membership areas. I say, listen to Joseph's first, then listen to mine, then listen to Joseph's second. And what you'll hear is, you know, there was a hidden and covert financial system. And what happened in 2009 was it overwhelmed and took over the whole system. And you cannot explain the financial system without having that history and integrating that history into your analysis. You can't.
Exactly.
Right.
That's my other point here with these 19th century models, because back then they were not dealing with models of nation states that had big, huge covert operations projects that were being funded or had to be funded over several decades. The first time we saw the emergence of that model, that financial structure in human history, was during World War II. And we saw it specifically with the enormous black projects that were put into place in Nazi Germany and in this country that had to be funded. And in both cases, that funding came out of doctoring the books. It came out of erecting fraudulent systems of finance using, you know, quite literally counterfeiting. And in this country's case, in 1947, it came out of the decision to keep all the Axis loot secret, to obfuscate the actual amounts of bullion that governments said or estimated were in existence in the world. So you're right. The other thing that these people have to be made aware of is not only are they working on too narrow a data set in terms of the public system of finance, but the other thing they're completely ignoring is this vast, huge system that you've pointed out is connected with the Exchange Stabilization Fund, that
right.
I think is connected to this Axis loot and to the bearer bond scandals. No one's paying attention to that adequately, in my opinion. So
right.
they simply have to be challenged on the assumptions of their models. They have to be brought up.
I bring this up because it's that group of people who control the most powerful technology. The technology we've been talking today, you know, particularly in the Anglo-American world, is controlled from the money. You know, whether they own it or they invest in it, and it's them who are driving this technology.
Right.
And you have to see that as one sort of integrated shift, move process. And without that, you can't begin to even see the governance or investment system on planet Earth. Because the question, of course, in my mind is, where are they going and what's next?
Well, this is the other part of the problem of their model, of their analytical model, and that is that they keep, you know, there's a certain segment of financial analysis out there that keeps harping on the central banking model is flawed, it's corrupt, it's falling apart, it's failed. You know, this is coming out of largely the Austrian School of Economics. And, I don't have any problem with the Austrian School of Economics per se, other than they're forgetting that there is this huge hidden system of finance.
Right.
And they're forgetting one of the consequences of that system was it put intelligence agencies, it put the national security intelligence apparatus directly into banking. So, you know, I've even entertained publicly many times the speculation that while everybody's mad at the banksters, they might really want to turn their attention to the financial technocrats in the national security structure that are managing a global economy that is based on international drug trade, that's based on all of this hidden system of Axis loot and how that's been rehypothecated over the years, creating enormous liquidity and leverage in the financial system. Until they look there, they're not going to be able to figure out why their models aren't working.
here's why I don't get mad at them, because I don't yet know what they're dealing with. In other words, if you judge somebody, you have to understand, if you were in their shoes, what would you do?
Right.
And, you know, since it was my partner's former partner, James Forrestal, who argued for transparency, I'm assuming I would have argued for transparency as well. But given that the decision was made to be non-transparent, we do not yet know what they're dealing with and why they're behaving the way they're behaving. And I think, to me, that is essential to understand. And we can't, the reason I get so mad at the finance guys is they're so smart. And we could really use their help figuring out what's really going on. And as long as they keep in those little narrowly confined circles, they're just going to go around and around. You know, it's like a gopher digging deeper and deeper.
Right. Well, I agree with you. I agree with you about not being too ready to condemn or judge the elite on this score, because as I attempted to point out at that secret space conference, after World War II, they were really confronted with an enormous threefold threat. I mean, they had to deal with the communist bloc. They had, in my opinion, they became immediately aware that there's this post-war Nazi thing that they hadn't really initially factored into their calculations,
right,
but that was still operative. And then finally, they had this UFO problem that was just gigantic, that they didn't want to talk about. And it's clear that they didn't want to talk about it. And that their strategic planning then had to take into consideration all three things and deal with them in a long-term strategic manner. And therefore, yeah, they opted for non-transparency because there was something that occurred to them in dealing with all this that they determined that for now we'd better keep this a secret. So, yeah, I agree with you. I wish the finance guys, at least one of them, would break ranks, and I keep hoping and praying that one of them.
I did.
Does.
One did.
Well, I know you did, but I mean, besides you. Yeah, I know you did, but you know, it would be nice if you had an ally out there. That's what I'm saying. You know, I keep hoping that some of these people will wake up and just think, okay, we've been making these predictions for years, and they keep not happening. So there's something wrong with the model. What is it? And if they have. You know, I'm with you, and this is the reason I've been spending so much time in the recent books talking about this hidden system of finance, because, like,
yeah,
I think this is a material omission, and we've got to wake some of these people up so that they can put their expertise to use and try and figure out, well, where has the money trail gone, what's it gone for, and what are the indications of the motivations behind these people that the money did this. I think if we can do that, then we've got a huge step forward in terms of our modeling of what we think is going to happen in the future.
It's really funny. I think I told you, because there are times that you and John Rappaport truly keep me sane. I was at a conference in October 2013 and gave a big speech. You know, everybody got up. It was a lot of finance guys saying, you know, it's all going to collapse and things are terrible. And I got up and said, oh, well, here's what we had. We had the legacy systems and this breakaway civilization. They stole $40 trillion and now they're resource rich. They've got new technology and they're building for it. It's going to be quite dazzling. And then the legacy systems are going to have to, you know, grind down their liabilities to everybody else. And when it was all over, the crowd was just like kind of stunned. They didn't know what to say. And finally, somebody raised their hand and said, I'm one of your subscribers. Could you explain what the black budget is? Because I don't think there's anybody here who's ever heard that term.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, oh, no, this is going to be a big shock. Yeah.
This is our principal problem for our future, is we have to redouble our efforts and make people aware not only of what the black budget is and how it works. There have been numerous books on it, but they have to start reaching a wider audience. And we also have to show them that in addition to that, you've got this huge harvesting mechanism that you've described, And in addition to that, you've got this hidden system that I think was put into place. So you've got an enormous financial system here that nobody's paying attention to.
Right, right. It's quite astonishing. It's quite astonishing.
Yeah, it really
but.
Is.
Yeah, there is a financial, the Matrix has a financial system.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, it's clearly this technology means that the financial system's going to evolve. And
oh, yeah.
So, you know, for another conversation on another day, new currency, shift to equity, lots going on, very deflationary pressures, particularly from the energy. But we're talking about reinventing the financial system with the technology, and so it's going to be wild. Well, Joseph, I can't thank you enough. This has been very, very informative and very helpful, and I would just encourage all of our Solari Report subscribers and all of Joseph's members, you've heard us talk about a lot of these developments. Just go online, go to Wikipedia and start reading about each one of them. There's a wealth of information, and these are things that are going to be impacting our individual lives, and I would encourage you to get to know about them, and let's make sure we use this technology in the service of love and peace instead of some of them. Some of the more dire ones being proposed. Any comments or summary you'd like to make before we close, Joseph?
No, I just want to thank you for having me back on and wish everybody happy holidays in the coming months, Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah and so on. So and we'll see you in the next quarterly.
Yes, you will. Have a wonderful day, Joseph.
Yep, you too, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on.
Thank you.